Today's scripture reading is from Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 through 6. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will rise upon you, and his glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look around. They all gather together, they come to you. Your sons shall come from far away, and your daughters shall be carried on their nurses' arms. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you. The young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. Today's theme reading is from Lawrence Krauss. One of the most poetic facts I know about the universe is that essentially every atom in your body was once inside a star that exploded. Moreover, the atoms in your left hand probably came from a different star than did those in your right. We are all literally star children, and our bodies made of stardust. Essentially, no nuclei, beyond lithium, the third lightest nucleus in nature, formed during the primeval fireball that was the Big Bang. While lithium is important for some people, far more important to the rest of us are the heavier nuclei, like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, and so on. These were not made in the Big Bang. The only place they can be made is in the fiery core of stars. And the only way they could get into your body today is if these stars were kind enough to have exploded, spewing their products into the cosmos so they could one day coalesce in and around a small blue planet located near the star we call the sun. Over the course of the history of our galaxy, about 200 million stars have exploded. These myriad stars sacrifice themselves, if you wish, so that one day you could be born. I suppose that qualifies them as much as anything else for the role of saviors.
We spent autumn in the dark wood. The dark wood was a metaphor for the via negativa, the way of letting go and letting be. It's the path in which we recognize the sacred and the holy in the not obvious or the not easily seen or through the hard knocks. Rather than see the dark as evil or sinful or bad or something to avoid or run away from, the path through the dark is also a path of growth. Now, at winter solstice, the light is reborn. So the reason for the season is the tilt of Earth's axis. The sun appears to us to be lower in the sky, but now through the summer solstice, the sun will appear to move higher and the days become longer. It happens every year. Our ancestors recognized this as a sacred and holy time, and they celebrated the return of the sun long before Jesus or ancient Israel. So if you can imagine a time before electricity, you can see how important this celebration would be. From 4:30 in the afternoon until 7:30 in the morning is a long time to be dark and cold, especially if there are no lights. So you can imagine their delight when the winter solstice finally came and they looked forward to more and more light as the days wore on. Winter solstice meant that the sun would not leave us forever, but would return. At the darkest point, the sun will rise. Each day there will be more light after the long, long, dark nights. And so these were stories that would develop around this, kind of all kinds of myths from many different cultures that would talk about a way of celebrating that event. The first evidence that Christians celebrated the birth of Jesus on December 25th actually comes from a Roman almanac in the 4th century. It's an almanac that records the death of all the prophets and the saints and bishops and martyrs and so forth. And the first date listed is December 25th, and it was marked Christ was born in Bethlehem of Judea. So that was the first evidence that we have of December 25th being celebrated by Christians mid 4th century, right around 350, just after Constantine. Another date was also celebrated for his birth. It competed with it, and it's celebrated in the Eastern Church, January 6th. It appears that the date of December 25th and January 6th were related to the Jewish calendar. So the death of Jesus was the first thing, and that was most important, was established for theology, established early at Passover, 14 Nisan, or then our calendar, March 25th. And so March 25th was noticed around Tertullian's time, around 200, as the date in which Jesus was executed, date of Passover. Well, it also, as the tradition developed, that a hero is often conceived on the day he dies. So March 25th became the date for the Annunciation by the angels to Mary, and so her conception. So Jesus is conceived and executed on the same date of the year. And 9 months after March 25th is December 25th. In the Eastern Church, they had the date of April 6th for his death, and this corresponding 9 months later, January 6th. So December 25th and January 6th were competing dates for Christianity with the Eastern and Western Church, for Christmas for the Eastern and Western Church. And December 25th really basically won the day for the birth of Jesus, although some Eastern churches still today celebrate his birth on January 6th. So in the West, we gave January 6th a special date, and we called it Epiphany, and celebrated that the day when the wise men would come from the East following the star, and Epiphany means manifestation, and the days between the 25th and the 6th are the 12 days of Christmas. You're supposed to keep your tree up, really, through the 6th. So if you want to come back in the middle of the week, then we can take the stuff down. But that's the idea. And so you see all these all these legends and stories build upon one another. Now, once Christianity became was recognized as the official religion of the Roman Empire, the date of December 25th became helpful for conversion. The church actively Christianized all of these established celebrations. So borrowing and legend building added to the stories and to the theology around the birth of Jesus. So the Son of God, S-O-N, is also the S-U-N, both rising from the east and returning. All of these stories, the theological puns are part of the whole history. So one can imagine the ease of connecting the Christian myth and theology with natural events and be able to talk to people about that. So it's probably not the case, even though you might read it on the internet, that December 25th was chosen for the birth of Jesus because of winter solstice celebrations. It was connected to the death conception of Jesus and with regards to the Jewish calendar. Because Christians really didn't care about the birth until much later. But it happened that the date of December 25th worked out rather nicely with winter solstice, and so the church capitalized on it. And we celebrated that part of it. And a great article, by the way, that talks about this is Andrew McGowan, Why December 25th Became Christmas. And I'll link to it when I post the sermon on the webpage. When I use the term religious myth, I'm not being dismissive. I'm being descriptive. Myth is the big, it's not like myth versus truth. Myth is the big story that is often beyond even our consciousness, that guides us and directs us, gives us meaning and purpose. So our emotions, our senses, our unconscious way of knowing are what we connect with myth. And we don't need to take the stories or myths, the individual legends, literally, but we need to kind of splash in it and celebrate it. Now, all of these stories are in our psyches, kind of displayed on a big screen. You think of all the stories of the Roman and the Greek gods and goddesses. They are our individual stuff played out there in story. So Hera, right, is the goddess of jealousy. Well, when Hera rises in us, that's that aspect. Or, and so all of these stories were connected to our own human psyche, our own individual way of thinking and knowing and feeling. So here's one of the challenges. When we learn the history and the science, so to speak, of how these stories came to be, I don't think it ruins the magic or takes it away, but adds to it. Hence the quote at the top of the bulletin by physicist Richard Feynman. Poets say science takes away from the beauty of the stars, mere globs of gas atoms. I, too, can see the stars on a desert night and feel them, but do I see less or more? Now, I'm not sure if all poets actually say that, but we do get his point. He can feel, too, even though he's a materialist scientist. Even though he understands the physics of the stars and probably understands them more than any other human being who has ever lived, Richard Feynman, after all. Nonetheless, on a desert night, he can still feel the stars as well as know them. Knowing doesn't take away the feeling. And I think that's an important lesson. Understanding the science that explores the working of Earth and of heaven does not take away its beauty. It enriches it. The same way is true for understanding our religious texts and our theology from an historical point of view. Understanding how the biblical texts came to be and how our theological doctrines developed doesn't take away their feeling or their truth. It does change the way we see, but again, in the words of Richard Feynman, do we see less or more? Well, now that you've been hanging out here with me for a year, you're probably getting my angle on how I approach our faith heritage and teach and preach about it. It's behind and underneath the texts that we get a glimpse of the people who told those stories and what was at stake for them. And that's our connecting point. We have similar things at stake. So we don't need to necessarily affirm or deny or believe or not believe what was said in these books and what was formulated in the creeds. That's not really their gift to us. Their gift is that they did it, and we can do it as well. We can enter into the stories and feel with them, and we can learn from historians and scientists who show us or unveil for us a little bit more of how the world works, how stories are made, how stars are made. So it's neither religion or science, but both and. For instance, Isaiah chapter 60 is known as 3rd Isaiah. Three different authors in this book, covering three different time periods. The first 39 chapters talk about the time before the exile, and that's the biggest historical event in the Hebrew Scriptures. It's when, around 586 BC, Judah was taken in captivity to Babylon. And almost all of the stories in the Old Testament reflect this period. Even as they look back. And so they take that story, so they're in exile, and then Cyrus the Persian came and conquered the Babylonians and freed the Jews to be able to go back home. And so Cyrus is actually noted as a Messiah in these early texts. So that's the major defining event. And Isaiah chapter 60 covers it all. It covers the before period, 1 through 39, the in the midst of it period during the suffering time in the exile, chapters 40 to 55. And then chapters 55 to 66 are the return or the afterward and the coming back. And so it's really happy, happy words there. So the reading from chapter 60 was used to tell in part the Christmas story. It's glorious, happy, hopeful poetry about the end of suffering at the hands of the Babylonians and a brand new start. The future is bright, according to the poet. So I'd like to disavow, first of all, any notion that the Hebrew prophets predicted Jesus, like Nostradamus predicted JFK. It's actually the other way around. The Christian storytellers looked back on their scriptures, their Hebrew scriptures, and borrowed stories to tell a new Jesus story. So when Isaiah talks about bringing, in that section that Deb read, gold and frankincense, that should sound familiar to us, he's not predicting the wise men from the East. The tellers of that story in Matthew borrowed from Isaiah those images in creating the story of the wise men or the astrologers. And that same author borrowed from the birth story of Moses to tell the birth story of Jesus. So the question is, well, why'd they do that? Well, these stories resonated with this new experience and this new hope amidst the darkness of their recent past. So there's another important historical event to have at the destruction of Judah and exile into Babylon, 586. There's another huge event that we don't get the Christian scriptures unless we get it, and that's the Jewish War of 66 to 70. And that's when the temple was destroyed, Jerusalem was destroyed, and all that was left of the temple is the Wailing Wall, which you go there, the Western Wall. That happened right as the Jesus story is starting to happen. Jesus happened, and then this happens, and then the Gospels are written. So it all reflects that period. So, Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is destroyed. How possibly can Isaiah chapter 60 be true? How can there be any light, any hope? How can God possibly be with us any longer? How could the God of Moses still be present after the entire city is razed, every Messiah crucified, children destroyed by violence, war, and complete humiliation? How does hope continue amidst the crush of Rome's empire? It's amazing that these folks survived it. The gospel writers were offering hope and possibility. Isaiah 60, they said, is still true, and it's finding its expression in the life and vision of the rabbi Jesus. The stories attached to Jesus were a way of preserving and interpreting the promise of the tradition. The message is clear. God has not abandoned us. God was not defeated. The suffering that we are experiencing is temporary. The light shines again, as sure as the sun will return at solstice. And when you can say that in the midst of so much violence, death, destruction, and dashed hopes, then you have faith. When you can say, "I will rise after falling so far," you have faith. And that's the Christmas Epiphany story. So we look to our ancestors for inspiration of how to survive the rough times. And that's the power and hope of all of our religious traditions. They are the imaginative stories of those who survived to tell the story. They include all the rough stuff. Well, a lot of it. They include the self-doubt, the self-defeating behavior, the mistakes, the grief, the hopelessness. They tell you amidst it, amidst the thick darkness, in the words of Isaiah, amidst the paranoia and ruthlessness of Herod, as Matthew tells it, of the light and hope and of possibility, of rescue, of a new start, a new birth. The sun will return. When I was a teenager, I used to enjoy going out at night when it was pitch dark and see the Montana stars. I grew up on a little farm in Whitehall, Montana. Now, Montana stars might not be the brightest stars on the planet, but they are brighter than many places like New Jersey. A big black canopy on fire with stars, too numerous to count. And they're beautiful even if I don't know anything about them. But now that I know that each of those little points of light is a sun or perhaps even a galaxy of suns, like ours, a source of heat and light to other planets, possibly other life, that is just amazing to me. The stars have life cycles, I've learned. They explode, and from these explosions, new suns are born, new planets are born. Every atom in our body comes from the material of exploding stars, as Lawrence Krauss talked about. The atoms in our left hand come from different stars, perhaps, than those in our right. Wow. So what are my problems in light of that? I have them. They're real. But really, this magnificent experience is before me as I lay on top of a haystack just 5 miles south of Whitehall in the dark, moonless, and star-filled night sky. What are we that you are mindful of us, says the psalmist, who also might have been gazing at the stars in a desert sky? And yet we matter. We matter to each other, to ourselves, to the experience of life itself. And I think that's what Epiphany is about. We need to be reminded of a bigger picture every now and then. We need to be reminded that as stars have their life cycles, so do we. One day we will not be, but right now we are. And it's amazing to be alive. There is suffering. There is darkness. But there is light. We can laugh again. We can be brave again. We can embrace. We can wipe the tears away and go outside and breathe deeply. Whatever changes happen in our lives, individually or collectively, and they will happen, we can know that our ancestors experienced them too. And yet they said, "Your heart shall thrill and rejoice because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you." Wow. Or from the opening words of the Gospel of John, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it." So we honor the light this season. As each day becomes brighter, we honor creativity, new life, new possibility, new hope. Arise and shine, for your light has come.